Welcome to the official Equine Affair podcast. This podcast is your inside look at everything to do with Equine Affair, from special events to exclusive interviews with top equine professionals and a whole lot more. I'm your host, Allison Renborg, and today we're chatting with Tania Creamer with Heart of Phoenix, which is a horse rescue based in Huntington, West Virginia. Heart of Phoenix Rescue is West Virginia's largest, most effective equine advocacy organization covering Appalachia, and we are excited for the opportunity to share their mission in this brand new episode of the Equine Affair podcast. Stay tuned for my interview with Tania. Welcome to the podcast, everybody, and a special welcome to our guest, Tania Creamer. So, hi, Tania.
Hey, how are you? Happy to be here.
I am great, and we are happy to have you here. Before we kind of dive into the interview, I wanted to read your bio from your website to our audience so that they have a better idea of who you are. And I don't normally do that, but it was such a succinct, perfect bio that kind of summed you up in just a few sentences. And so I thought our audience needs to hear this. So, Tania is a lifetime horse owner and a rescuer since childhood of any animal someone else failed. It is who I am, have always been. And I mean, I can't think of a better bio to be proud of than that as a horse owner and a horse lover. And so that's why I wanted to share that with our audience. So it sounds like Heart of Phoenix is an extension of that passion for you. Is that right?
It is, and it's even more, I think, than just who I was. There was a point in my life where I lost two younger brothers and a sister in a fire when I was in my mid-20s. And at that point, I did not have horses in my life at that moment. And it was when... As about a year moved on after that fire, I started noticing that horses were just being abandoned and dropped off at auction and being given away in large numbers around 2008, 2009. Mm-hmm. And I remember saying, somebody has to do something about this. And I realized there were two things. If I recognized a need, I had to try to help. But also that my life had become pretty vacant after that tragedy, and horses had always been what filled my childhood. And it was a lot of, you know, missing family members, you know, makes you think a lot about, you know, when you were young and you were growing up together. And the other thing that I had always been horses. And so in many ways, while it was a desperate need here in West Virginia and Appalachia, and I was glad to be able to start something that ultimately has essentially solved that need, it was also very therapeutic for me at a time when I needed something that mattered.
Well, I mean, it's so beautiful. And I think it's summed up probably, I would guess, in the name of your rescue, that you took something tragic, like a fire where you lost family, and you turned it into something beautiful and fulfilling and helpful to others.
Yeah, the name, it even has that same kind of, you know, double-sided story. It summed up what had happened with me with finding something that I could make some type of revolutionary change. Mm-hmm. But it also was very much about the first horse that I did rescue and that we could not save her. You know, it was too late. We came too late. And many things about that first real intense rescue changed the way I would do things moving forward. And so, you know, very much about my story, very much about her story, that even though we weren't able to save her, she wasn't going to be forgotten. We were going to continue to do this and be successful at it. And we have been.
That's amazing. And so profound and so sad, but also so wonderful that you have gone on to be successful and saved, I think, is it at least 500 horses so far? Is that right?
We're probably looking at pushing 800 at this point.
Wow. That's amazing. And when did you start Heart of Phoenix Rescue?
So I did the first rescues I did on my own was in the end of 2009, 2010. Okay. It changed from an individual effort on my own because I recognized that there was no way for me to do this well on my own. And that's true of any organization. But at that point, it was more of a private endeavor. And I saw the ability to make it an organization. So we started doing things as a group in 2011, and we got our 501c3 status in 2012.
Okay. So 800 horses in not that many years.
And it grew slowly at first, and I think that's the way it should have grown. In the first 5 years, it was slow growth. It was small. It was just learning how to do it well. But there came a point where we knew we were doing it well, and it just exploded. The number of people willing to help, and the support of people even outside of our region just changed what we were able to do. And it literally went from holding 6 horses to 12 horses, to 20 horses. And that was slow. But then once we were hitting the 80 horse mark from that point, the number of adoptions really increased. The number of trainers willing to work with us for very little funding on our end, that increased. We developed the Appalachian Trainer Face-Off, which is a 100-day program modeled a little bit after the Extreme Mustang Makeover, but using all breeds that come through rescue. That allowed us to take in far more horses, because as that event grew, more trainers and more trainers stepped in. So we could have 60 horses out in training while holding 60 new intakes. And so the process just started to work really well, so that we could, at this point we can hold 120 plus horses at any given time, thanks to trainers and fosters and our facility expansion. But the number of adoptions just started to work, and that just changed everything about how many we could impact.
That's wonderful. And so you all are in West Virginia, but do you work with, kind of talk me through your region, like where do these trainers live that you're able to foster horses out to? Do you guys go beyond West Virginia?
We focus on rescuing horses primarily from West Virginia, Kentucky, Ohio, but we adopt and foster and use trainers all over the Eastern United States, and as far as even has been instances of Texas, and up into Indiana, Illinois, New Jersey. So we've really covered this whole region, or even creeping out toward the Midwest some, just because we work really hard to work well with others. And that sometimes isn't seen in all animal welfare organizations, but we've tried to make sure that the equine industry isn't, that they don't feel like they're not part of rescue. They are, they're part of it. The trainers we depend on, the horse industry, the show circuits, everything that's done well, because the adopter and the success of the horse that is adopted depends on a good, strong horse industry. So we've never tried to isolate ourselves as if we don't need the outside horse world. And I think that rolls into equine affair. We always wanted to be a part of that. That's the horse industry. We want to be where the horse industry is. And that's how we have grown the way that we have, and got trainers that are in Illinois to say, I want to help you. We're in West Virginia. We're not close to you, but they want to help us. And I remember I got a call from Michael Lyons. He's Josh Lyons' brother. And he says, hey, I'd like to train a horse for you guys. And I said, well, you would, that would be great. And I said, but Michael, we're in West Virginia. Why do you want to, why come so far away? Aren't there rescues closer to you? And he said, there are rescues everywhere, but I want to help you guys. You're the organization I want to work with. And so, it's Heart of Phoenix focusing on Appalachia, but actually working all over the United States is kind of the vision.
Well, and I think that's got to be part of your success, because if there's one thing we know, it's we can't solve a problem like horses in need without collaborating across disciplines, across horse people, across regions. I mean, it's, we can solve one problem here if we just isolated and focused on one thing, but that doesn't solve the whole problem. That just solves one particular issue. So I love that you guys are focused on collaborating and reaching out and networking, and how cool that you received that phone call from Mr. Lyons about wanting to work with you. So that kind of rolls perfectly into my next question, which is, let's talk about how you all are associated with Equine Affair.
Well, so I remember when we first started talking about doing a booth, and some of that came from the way we had grown, and we had really gotten connected with a longtime horse trainer here that is near Charleston, West Virginia. And Susan had been attending Equine Affair since the first ever. She would be happy to tell anyone I was at the very first one. And she would say, I think we should set up a booth. And at first I did say, and this was many years ago, I would say, I don't think that's our audience. And I was wrong. You know, that was before I really understood that the industry had to be part of all of our work. And finally we did a booth. It went really well. And then we had the Appalachian Trainer Face-Off. It was the second year we had that event. It takes place in West Virginia. The trainer that won, Brenda Hansen, she was going to, she went on, she won that event for us. Then she went over and she won the Horse and Rider Versatility competition at the Columbus Equine Affair. So we were there to be supportive of that. And at that same year, we had set up when they, the adoption booths, where rescue horses could be on display. And it was an incredible, I thought, very innovative idea that the Equine Affair, I think with some collaboration with the Ride Horse, put on. And for me, that was just an incredible event. So we were there, we had horses, we got horses adopted at the event, tons of exposure and just really a very positive experience. And then later that year, Brenda Hansen took one of our horses to Massachusetts and competed with her at the Horse and Rider Versatility in Massachusetts. And we went up there and the news was there because that particular horse has a really great story. So then one of our horses has been a competitor at Equine Affair. We've set up, you know, both as a vendor and then as an adoption partner. And then, you know, the trainers, some various trainers that work with us also compete. And, you know, we wanted to be there to support them.
I love it. And what a great success story. And I think we've had Brenda on the show before, and she's a great horsewoman. So that's so, so cool to hear that connection and that rescue horse went on to do great things.
It was incredible because she was also the youngest horse there. And she really was, she was a little quarter horse filly. We went into a situation. It was a really bad neglect case with law enforcement. And she was 1 year old. She was the size of a 3 month old foal, and her legs, the tendons were all contracted, and she had pneumonia, and she was in early stage liver failure. And I said, guys, we can't rehab her. It's not kind. I don't think she can survive sound. And I don't think that she will recover. And I had already rehabbed hundreds of horses in gruesome condition, but hers was so stark, and her legs especially. And soundness and a healthy horse matters. And I said, I don't think this is going to go well. And the vet and her foster said, well, let's just see. She's so young. You never know what changes could happen. And I said, well, that's true. You know, it's amazing what youth will allow you to recover from in humans and in animals. So we tried. And in a month's time, her legs were perfect. The tendons were not contracted. They looked fantastic. She started to gain weight. Her organ function went back to normal. She recovered. We kept her until she was a three-year-old and put her in the Appalachian Trainer Face-Off. Brenda Hansen picked her. And if anybody would see her video, the before, after, the whole story, and then Brenda with her footage of her freestyle, it was unbelievable. I mean, there wasn't a dry eye in the place. There just couldn't have been. And then to know that she went on to be an event, the youngest horse in that event. I mean, it's not an easy event. And Brenda had not had her back in training very long, and they did really well. And it was just everything about the story was beautiful.
Oh, that's awesome. And are those videos on your Facebook or your website, or how can people see them?
So if anyone wants to see Sansa's story, you can go to YouTube and go to WV Horse Rescue, and she will come right up. I mean, I think some of her videos have a million views or so, but just the one I did about a year ago has everything in it. It has her with Brenda in the freestyle winning the Appalachian Trainer Face-Off, and it also has Brenda up in Massachusetts at Equine Affair with her under Chris Cox as the judge. And it just tells her story perfectly. And it's definitely a must see for any horse person. You'll cry. You'll need tissues.
Okay, noted. And we'll put that link in the episode description too. So if you didn't catch the URL, we'll have it where you can click on it if you're listening. So that kind of brings me to my next question is, can we talk about some of the rescue situations that you encounter most frequently? And then how does your organization get involved with those?
So the most common thing lately, you know, is owner surrenders. And we're just really well known. So those are pretty straightforward. It's an owner in a crisis that needs help. Maybe the horse is still healthy. Maybe the horse really needed to be given away a long time ago. We try to be non-judgmental. We don't want to empower people to continue in that kind of cycle, but we want to help them and make them feel like, hey, we're here. You know, we can help you. This doesn't have to happen anymore. We can take this horse. So that's very common. The scarier parts of what we do are animal control seizures with law enforcement. We do a lot of that. At one point, we did more of that than anything else. I think COVID has changed and backed up the legal systems in states so much that we haven't been on as many welfare calls in the last year. But it can look like this. Pull up, there's a trailer, there's a meth lab in the trailer. Person in trailer does not want you to take the horse or the meth lab. They're not happy. Everyone's in bulletproof vests except Heart of Phoenix, because we're not actually law enforcement. I say, hey, we maybe need a vest. Ah, we don't have any. We go untie horse from trampoline beside trailer. As the guy runs out and says, you're not taking my horse, and law enforcement has to intervene and carry the man away in handcuffs. So that's kind of, you know, that's the way it usually looks.
Wow.
We go in and take horses. If they have to decide between protecting the child that may be taken, the drugs that may be taken, or the horse, it tends to where they get most upset about the horse, which is tells you a lot about the situation. But so we go in, we do that. We don't charge counties anything. We live in a very poverty-stricken state. There's no money a county has to cover what it would cost to seize horses. So, you know, we have to be able to fund that, the recovery of the horses, the holding of the horses, you know, and I go and testify at the cases. We also do law enforcement training for in-hour service for law enforcement to know what should you be doing if we aren't with you, if there's an equine case and you wonder if there's a neglect situation or, and how do you keep yourself safe handling horses if we're not available? So we try to just be a resource in every way as far as that goes. The third thing that we do, which is probably the most dangerous, is West Virginia and Kentucky have mine sites that are active or have been reclaimed, land top removal sites that are covered in horses. It started about 12 years ago. They've been there on and off for decades, but it really became a problem in the economic downturn in 08 and people just turning their horses out. And then also, some of the herds are managed by traders that run horses through auctions like Sugar Creek. We, and the horses end up, you know, obviously breeding, and then you have what is now potentially several thousand feral horses that cover the lands. So we developed the Appalachian Trainer Face-Off event as a way to have trainers involved in a competitive way to where we could remove these horses, send them with trainers and get training in a way that we could afford, because there are so many horses out there and they need so much work. So while lots of horses go into that event, there are always some that come off the strip mines. So the problem we run into that dealing with feral horses out on rural land is not easy. Everything about getting there in your truck is or ATV is dangerous. The local people are very hostile to you removing horses, even though they're abandoned or feral and not living on land that belongs to them. Even though they get hit by cars, injured by predators, injured on the mine sites, it's very hostile. And there's very little cell phone service, no real way for law enforcement to respond. So it's the most dangerous thing that we do, but it is the work of my lifetime is to get those horses off of these lands and into a home. So especially in, 2020, 2021, we've really tried to focus on getting as many as we can off those sites. And actually, we just had volunteers out, a volunteer trainer and a volunteer who works with the Department of West Virginia through Environmental Protection out there. And they ran into a guy who was extremely violent, and they were lucky to get out of there because he didn't want the horses moved, even though it's not his land and they're really not his horses. So it's a very challenging kind of unique situation to Southern West Virginia and Eastern Kentucky, but it's something that really rates, the horses rate help. So we try to focus on that as much as we can lately.
Yeah, that is something that I knew nothing about and wouldn't have imagined happening in West Virginia and Kentucky. And maybe that's a lack of imagination on my part. But wow. And how did you, is this just a really well-known problem to everyone in that state, or how did you find out about it?
Well, so I am from Southern West Virginia. And mm-hmm. So it's something that I had family there talking about it back in probably 2009. And I said, this isn't real. No. Mm-hmm. And I went out and saw it myself, and I started talking about it on social media, and I was met with 100% resistance. This is not true. Now, that was in 2009-10. Mm-hmm. This is not true. But as years have gone on, it is something that is pretty widely known in our region, but mm-hmm. it isn't something that's nationally known as much. Now, last year in Eastern Kentucky, 26 horses were shot on a strip mine. It was primarily pregnant mares. And the scene was so heartbreaking. These mares aborted. They were all heavily bred mares out on this strip mine. They were shot. And that was actually ended up on national news, but you mm-hmm. know, it wasn't a breaking story on every station, but it was at least something to get it out there in a more widely known fashion. So at this point, we just try to continue to raise awareness. We've been able to get some funding from some wild horse organizations that focus on Mustangs, but also realize that this situation rates intervention to allow us to do a little more this year than usual. But I encourage people to learn about it. You can go to heartofphoenix.org. Mm-hmm. And if you go to the search bar and you type mine, just M-I-N-E, it will bring up probably 40 blogs where we have catalogs, videos, rehabs, us out on these mine sites. The number of horses would just blow somebody's mind. And we continue constantly weekly to gather more video, more photos. There are a couple of organizations in Kentucky that also work on the issue. Kentucky actually enacted legislation that I was a little involved in maybe 6 years ago that set parameters for how the horses could be removed off of those sites in Kentucky, but West Virginia doesn't have anything legislation-wise. So it's something that if you just do some searching, it's very interesting. I encourage horse people to do it. It's a crisis, and there are people on both sides of the fence. There are people that say leave them out there mm-hmm. and that they're fine and they're healthy, and it is not true. They're not fine. They're not healthy. Sometimes there are healthy horses out there, but if they're out there long enough, it tends that things change. And then the people are on the side that say, we need a plan, you know, to get these numbers reduced and get these horses off this land and into Definitely. A home.
Yeah. Because I mean, the more horses you have, the more overgrazing happens, the less food there's going to be. In addition to all the other things you listed of they get injured, they get hit by cars, that kind of thing. So thanks for sharing that. I think hopefully our audience will take that to heart and go search on your website to look for information about that and maybe get involved. And we'll list your websites and points of contact for everybody again at the end of the episode. But I think that's a really important situation that is not that far away from me, honestly. I'm in Tennessee and I had no idea. So thank you for your work there. Let's talk about something that occurred to me is this happens all over the United States, but sometimes people, whether with good intention or bad, just turn horses loose in national parks or in nearby parks or in the woods between suburbs and that kind of thing. Do you think that that's happening in the mine sites too, that people are turning domestic Yes. horses loose out there?
Yes. I mean, that's really where the herds have come from originally. And they've just mm-hmm. continued to breed because it's so rural and inhospitable. Mm-hmm. So it's not an area that's easy to remove anything you've put out there if it doesn't want removed or if it goes unnoticed and starts to breed. So it's a situation like that. With the extra component of sometimes horse traders are putting horses out there intentionally with the thought they'll go back and get them in 6 months and gather them up and run them through an auction, make a few dollars. So it's a twofold problem, but it's a large number of just been abandoned because they didn't know what to do. Now, it doesn't happen as much now, but back in 08, Heart of Phoenix didn't exist. So if you had a horse and you didn't know what to do with it in West Virginia because you couldn't take care of it, you didn't want to, it had an injury you didn't want to address, you just, that's what people did in that region. They just took them out there and turned them loose. And then the breeding that happened, I think, was beyond what anybody expected. A large number die, but so many were dropped off and able to hang in there and start to breed that now you have herds out there that are, you know, as many as 8-10 generations feral.
Yeah. I remember here in Tennessee in 2008 and 2009, the downturn, people were tying horses to trees by the side of the road and just leaving. It was a really hard time for everyone. And then especially for the horse industry. And then who suffered? A lot of the time it was horses. So let's say you all rescue a horse, whether that's from the meth lab trampoline situation you referenced, or you bring a horse in from the mines, then what happens? How do you guys start processing that horse through your program, getting vet care, all those things?
So we're really fortunate to have both a local vet that's incredible and a wonderful relationship with Rudin Riddle in Lexington, Kentucky for intense cases. Our local vet has a process. It's a package deal. Every horse gets, when they come in, they get blood work, they get a fecal, they get dewormer when it's safe and what is applicable to what the fecal results say. They get a full panel of vaccinations. They get a Coggins, they get an exam. We freeze brand and microchip all of our horses and do their teeth. The minute they come in, unless there's some reason we can't, either behavioral because they're feral and they need some training, then we may have to wait. Maybe there's a medical condition that makes certain things not wise to do. So every horse gets that done. Most horses start rehabilitation at our main facility in Huntington, West Virginia. Some horses, if they're not critical, very quickly will be vetted and they'll go to a foster because that allows individual attention. And horses really flourish when they're in a situation that's almost like they're someone's horse. Because the truth is, in a large animal shelter, which is what our rescue barn is, and it's a large animal shelter, you know, you may have 45 horses there. And while we have live on site caretakers, certain horses really thrive being someone's horse. So if we feel like this horse isn't thriving in this large program, we have tons of fosters that can step in. We just like the horse to be vetted and stable before they move on to a foster. And then as the horse rehabs, we just want to know, who is this horse? What do they know? It tends that most of the horses need training. So if it's a horse that needs some training, we will go ahead and find an adoption partner trainer, you know, and send that horse to that trainer to get what it needs done until it can get a home. If the horse needs an extensive amount of training, we will hold that horse until Appalachian Trainer Face-Off pickup happens each year in May. So if a horse is going to need 100 plus days of really focused, intense training, or if the horse is feral, we're usually going to hold that horse. Even if we rescue that horse in June, we're going to rehab the horse, hold the horse, get the horse as far as we can until it can go into that program for the 100 days of training for the competition that starts in the middle of May and runs through the end of August. So that's pretty much 50% of the horses we get. It's tending, we're holding for that event these days. The other 50% are either they come in and they actually have had a lot of training, they maybe need some rehab, they maybe had an injury that just needs some time, a different type of treatment, or never had treatment, or they just need a tune-up, are green, or have had an owner that really caused issues that we can correct within the facility. And then they'll just go on to an adoption, an adopter as soon as they're ready. And we want a horse to get a home as soon as it's ready to get a home. That may take, in some horses' instance, a year. It may take 6 months, you know, it's just when the horse is ready to find a home, we do want it to find a home. That's the best thing for the horse. Hanging out in our facility is not, that's not a home. So we have a real adoption focused goal, but we want to do it when the horse is ready. We don't we won't really send horses out until we know who the horse is and the horse's health issues, if there are any, are addressed and the horse is doing well.
Right. Right. And I think that's so true that horses really, most horses flourish when they're somebody's horse, you know, especially if they've been through a really difficult situation, they have a lot of trauma, that there, nothing really replaces that one-on-one attention if they can get it. So I think that's great. How do you all vet your potential adopters?
So what we do is we have two paths. If you've owned horses before, you'll do a conditional application, and we're going to ask you for your current vet, your farrier, your equine dentist, if applicable. If it's not your vet, we're going to ask for your income, proof of income, your driver's license, your horse history. How many horses have you had? Where do they end up? You know, we want to establish that you're looking for a horse. We get that horses can't be with somebody forever. That's idealistic. Sometimes they can, but that's not what we're looking for. Consistency, that you're dedicated to this horse for the time that it works, in your life and the discipline you're in. And, so we're looking for somebody we can depend on to really care about the adoption process and keep us updated about the horse once it's adopted. And we've rehabbed the horse, I've fundraised and made sure the money was there for the horse. So we want to make sure you're going to let us know how the horse is doing, and that you're going to provide good care. So we'll ask for personal and professional references and just get a sense of who you are as a horse person and as an individual, and try to figure out where your skill set really is. Like, unfortunately, people will often think they're a level, you know, they're upper level rider, but in truth, they're not. And we don't want to set the horse or the adopter up for a disaster. So we just try to talk to enough people and the adopter to get a sense of, here are horses that would work for you. So once you're approved, you can meet horses that we think make a lot of sense for you and how you've screened as an adopter. And sometimes people will put a horse down. They'll say, hey, I'd like to adopt so-and-so. We screen and we say, listen, so-and-so is not going to work for you. So-and-so needs this type of rider and this type of facility. But we do have these five horses. And I mean, people usually are just looking for a good fit. I mean, if it's not that difficult to get somebody to, if you're kind and sensible, to get somebody to say, okay. And so they'll come out and we just look for a fit. So meet the horses that you're interested in. It's our goal that we're giving you a horse that you guys are going to be good partners, because the horses come back to us if it doesn't work. So it's not in our interest or the adopter or the horse's interest to have the wrong horse leave with an adopter. So right. We're just real committed to it being a good fit. But sometimes you just don't know how it's going to work till you go home with the horse. And so it's reassuring for adopters to know, if it doesn't work, it's not a big deal. We're fine with that. We'll just come get the horse. If you want to try again with a different horse, that's okay, you know, and just make them feel like they have a support base within the organization, you know, because they're now part of what we do. You know, you're not independent from the organization. You're a part of this process, and we want it to work for you. So you really have a team of people that will help. If you start having issues with the horse, we're happy, if within reason, to try to get a trainer out to work with you or have them talk to you on the phone, talk you through any concerns. And the same thing with health-wise, if you you know, something pops up in a year or 4 years, you know, we want to be there to help in whatever way we can.
I love that. And it's really important, because I even think back to I adopted a dog last year from a rescue situation, and I was worried she wouldn't get along with my cat. And I said, hey, if she doesn't get along with my cat, can I give her back? And they were like, of course you can. And of course, that wasn't what I wanted. And happily, she got along great with the cat, and we've been one happy family. But it really is reassuring that, okay, I'm committing and I want this to work. But if it doesn't, you know, I have to be realistic. Then what happens? And so I think that's so important for rescues, especially of big animals like horses, to provide that reassurance to an adopter. I think that's really key.
Well, and another component is that, you know, realistically, I know some organizations focus on it has to be forever. And I think that's a nice idea, but also I understand, as a mother of children, that the ponies they've had, they had to be somebody else's ponies before they could be my boy's first ponies, you know? Mm-hmm. had to have that horse that had already been there and done that. So we tell people, especially newer riders, as you go along, if you can't afford two horses, and as you go along, you outgrow your horse, it's okay to say, this horse could go on to teach someone else. And that's what we need. And so I can afford one horse, and now I can compete at a different level. I need a different horse. But this horse has so much to give to some other new rider or young rider or child. And so we really try to explain that if that happens, it's fine. We will take that horse back, find the next right home for this horse to continue doing and sharing and learning with someone that's new, or perhaps you just change your discipline. Those are things we're fine with that. It's part of the horse industry, and it's how new riders learn and grow. And if everyone keeps that horse that's so bomb-proof and beginner-proof, even though I don't really love that term, but, you know, a good beginner's, there's no horse is really bomb-proof, but that good beginner horse or that good first level, like upper intermediate horses, you've moved on. And, you know, those horses can go on to teach so much and make more good riders and good owners. So we just let people know, just because you adopt, we'd like the horse to stay with you forever if that's possible. If it's not, the horse can always come back, and we will find the next person that horse will be a partner with. And really, as long as the horse is cared for, we haven't found they take that very hard. They're like, you feed me, you scratch me, this is great, you know. So we want people to know that that we're there for that. And sometimes, especially if a child's growing and new, we're such a, it's just a safety net. It's a worry off your mind. I don't have to worry what's going to happen to my kid's horse.
Yeah, that's a great way to look at it. So in our last few minutes here, I wanted to ask you about, of course, you guys do rescue, but then you also do education and advocacy. And I think we've touched on those different aspects, but do you want to share some more about how you all try to educate the public?
Well, so one of the things that I have said for years is I don't believe we have a horse overpopulation problem. I believe we have too few qualified horse people. And so our way to address that is, let's put information out there that has nothing to, you don't have to have a rescue horse to follow our page. We work hard all the time, both online and in person, to give the horse community resources of information, both on training and health and care, every single day. We would like to just continue to be a resource to any horse person, because by making horse people better, then horses are able to stay in their homes, and they're able to not develop bad habits that turn them into the horse that ultimately ends up at an auction. The more people know about their health and the way that they work mechanically, the less injury happens, the less apt they are to be that blown up barrel horse. The better riders that we cultivate, the higher caliber horse they can handle. So we don't just need to get inquiries for beginner bomb-proof horses. We can get inquiries for horses that aren't easy, but are talented, that require a really good rider. So we just believe the answer to the horse neglect problem and the cycle of horses being bought and resold continually until they end up in a bad situation is creating a really solid, good horse community that has a lot of knowledge and that is constantly looking for knowledge. So that's really where we try to place ourselves, is just a source of good information, whether it's training or care, anything like that. And because we think that would ultimately put the rescue out of a job, and that would be a wonderful ending.
It would. That would be a happy ending to a long story of ups and downs.
For sure.
All right. And so now, if people want to learn more about you, maybe they're a trainer who wants to partner with you, or someone who wants to adopt, or someone who just wants to follow and learn, like we were talking about, what are some of the best ways for them to do that?
So we're very, very active on Facebook. If you just type in Heart of Phoenix Equine Rescue, we will come right up. We have a pretty active Instagram as well. Same thing with just type in Heart of Phoenix. We don't do a ton on YouTube, but a lot of our story and our before and afters are there just to understand like what we do in a nutshell through video at wvhorserescue.org. And then our blog is heartofphoenix.org and just has thousands of blogs about most any topic you could ever imagine. And if there's not an issue we cover, we will always be happy to reach out, get the information, and do a blog on a topic if it's of interest to someone and we think it'll help.
Perfect. So, all right, audience, you have many different ways to get educated and to learn more about Heart of Phoenix. So I encourage you to go out and do that and get involved with equine rescue in your area. So that wraps up our episode. And I just want to thank you, Tania, for joining us today and for sharing your mission and your heart for horses in need, because I think we need more people like you.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. All right, everybody. Stay tuned for our next episode, and we'll see you at Equine Affair. Thanks for listening to the official Equine Affair podcast. I am your host, Allison Renborg. Equine Affair gratefully acknowledges its sponsors, Absorbine, U.S. Equestrian, Rods, Farnham, Cosequin, Neutrina, Cashman's, Horizon Structures, and GGT Footing. We plan to be back at the Eastern States Exposition in West Springfield, Massachusetts on November 11 through 14, 2021, and at the Ohio Expo Center in Columbus, Ohio on April 7th through the 10th, 2022. You can buy tickets, see the full event schedules, and all the latest news at equineaffair.com. And finally, please catch up on all our past episodes online by visiting equineaffair.com/home/podcast.